Genesis chapter 11. Continuing our series through the book of Genesis, this is now message number 12, entitled Prevailing Speech. We'll be looking at all of Genesis chapter number 11. We'll be beginning with verses 1 and 2. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. So chapter 10 records the origins of the nations, and the context there is after the flood. The setting is the world that God ordered after the flood. And the chapter gives the descendants of Noah's three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. But it isn't a genealogy as much as it is a table of nations. And we have 70 nations that are listed there. Many of them are traceable to us, while others are lost to us or just simply unknown to us. Now, nations in chapter number 10 are given several identifying characteristics or factors in this chapter. So this is how the Bible identifies nations. There's a kinship in family or tribal relations that results in a certain ethnicity. There's a common language, though the next chapter tells how the languages were divided. Nevertheless, chapter 10 gives that as one of the features. There's a political structure. There's a government, some sort of overarching government within that nation. And there is inheritance of particular lands with geographic boundaries. So as we look at chapter 10, and we get the origin of the nations of the world, we get these certain defining characteristics of what national identity is about in the Bible. And so as we read forward in the Bible, we know that the nations are important in God's purpose for his kingdom. So the nations will receive their inheritance of the earth for those that believe of those nations. And we see that even in places like Revelation. And we know that nations will exist as nations in the millennial kingdom and in the eternal ages. Now, we don't know exactly what that's going to look like. And so here's just sort of an example of the type of maybe difficulty or maybe lack of clarity that we have. So, for instance, we can trace the nation of Egypt all the way back to this table of nations in Genesis chapter number 10. But how closely linked is the modern nation of Egypt with the Egypt that we can get all the way back into antiquity? And why I say that is that if you look at modern Egypt is dominated by Arabs. But these weren't the original Egyptians. So the original Egyptians in antiquity are probably much closer to the smaller group within Egypt of the Copts. That's the C-O-P-T-S, the Copts. So the Copt people are much more likely, more directly connected with ancient Egypt that we'd read about here in the book of Genesis than are much of what is considered in the modern nation of Egypt. So the question then is, well, which one is Egypt? And how do you figure, who's going to, what this is going to look like and who's going to receive what and what have you? And if you think about it, it's that way among many nations. Well, the truth is, we're just not told how that's going to work out. We're not given that kind of information. Now, if you contrast that with what we are told about the nation of Israel, though, with the nation of Israel, we have a lot more information about the specific promises of future fulfillment that details how that they are going to come into possession of the inheritance of land and nation promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, we're not given that pertaining to Egypt or any of these other nations. Now, we will have a little bit more information about the nations when we get to the Abrahamic covenant, but we're not there yet. So now we've come to chapter number 11. And chapter 11 gives us an explanation for the table of nations in Genesis 10, and it also gives us a conclusion to the table of nations. Now, this is obviously a new section that starts here, as you see the way that chapter 10 ends with, these are the families of the sons of Noah after their generations, in their generations, and by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood, which is essentially about the way that the chapter starts. So you've got a section there that's enclosed, this table of nations. And so chapter 11 comes along, and it's definitely connected to that. It's definitely meant to be read after that. And it gives us an explanation of this table, and it's particularly an explanation of the dividing of the nations. But this chapter also gets us from Noah to Abraham. And it's Abraham and his descendants that will take up the rest of the book of Genesis. So by the time you get to the end of chapter 11, you already have Abraham, and you've got all the way to chapter 50 to go, and Abraham and his descendants are going to dominate all the rest of Genesis and all the rest of the Pentateuch for that matter. Now, the Table of Nations breaks the pattern. When we look at chapter 10, it broke that pattern when it came to Nimrod. So chapter 10, verses 8 to 10, Nimrod is described there as a warrior, as a builder of cities. He particularly building cities in the land of Shinar. And so we're told in chapter 10 that the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom was actually Babel. And so we're set up now to read this account in chapter 11, this account of Babel, the introduction of the languages that happened there. And we realize that common and distinct languages is one of the identifiers of nations in chapter 10. And so we get the nations divided by their languages in chapter number 11. So when you read this account, it does have some similarities to the creation to fall to flood accounts. There's a number of places where you get some similarities. There are some differences as well. But one of the ways that we see some similarity is that we see the remarkable consistency of sin. And I don't know that I've ever really spent a lot of time thinking about that, but sin is remarkably consistent. People tend to sin in the same ways and in the same ways as their ancestors before them and their ancestors before them. And so we get this picture of creation and after the fall and leading up to the flood. And now soon after the flood, we're getting another picture. And so it really shows us what we refer to theologically as the depravity of man, that all of man has been affected by sin. But even after the radical judgment and destroying every living thing on the earth with a flood is a radical judgment. And even after a radical judgment like the flood, we get mankind going right back to where they were before the flood. This account also, in thinking about some of the similarities, it also helps us to see how that God acts, but not out of reaction to man, but God is acting according to his predetermined plan. So God is not just encountering, what have they come up with now, kids these days. No, he's not reacting to things that man is doing as if, he has no knowledge of it or, he didn't see that coming or something like that. Rather, God is acting toward his predetermined plan. So just as God spoke to Noah and gave a promise and said, I will never again destroy every living thing on the earth with a flood. And here we are at Babel, right back where we were right before the flood. Well, what's God going to do? Is he going to wipe everybody out? And he doesn't do that. He keeps his promise. And there's another similarity, and that would be that emphasis on God speaking. We have seen how that God speaking is very important thematically in the creation account, in the fall account, in the flood account with Noah. God speaking is emphasized repeatedly. And when you read this Tower of Babel account, which particularly comes in the first part of this chapter, and you pay attention to the way it's constructed, it goes in, it's almost laid out like a psalm. It's almost laid out in a sort of a poetic structure that you start at the beginning and you work to a midpoint, and then you start working back toward the end. And as you're working back toward the end, you're getting a reverse mirror of what the first half of the account was. So it's put forth in a very formal way, and it's put forth precisely in a way that emphasizes speaking. So the one interesting thing about this account, though, that would be somewhat of a difference is that we also get an emphasis on men speaking. And so we get a little bit of an interesting twist to that speech. So as we look at this chapter really has two main parts to it. We have verses 1 to 9, where we read about the tall tower that they built in Babel. And then in verses 10 to 32, where we get that genealogy, that the purpose of which is to move us from Shem to Abraham. So let's begin here in the first section about the Tower of Babel. And we'll begin here. Let's read verse 1 again. "And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech." So it starts out by giving us this setting. We know many other details. We know about the order of the earth and the cycles of the earth and nature as God has established after the flood. We know about God's promises to Noah. We also know about the nations that have descended. We also know that God has instructed mankind to bring forth, to be fruitful, to multiply, to fill the earth, and not only to fill the earth, but to spread, but to divide and spread over the earth. Chapter 10 brings us back to those appointed and allotted boundaries and territories for those nations. Now, so we're given the setting here that the whole earth, all of the nations of the earth at this time, had one language and one speech. So, first of all, we're not given a lot of good time markers to place this event in Babel, like when exactly that had happened. Essentially, what we can do by going through chapter 10 and the genealogy given at the bottom of chapter number 11, we figure that Peleg was born to Eber about 101 years after the flood, and that's according to the list of Shem at the end of this chapter. Well, chapter 10, verse 15 states that the dividing of the nations happened in the days of Peleg, during his lifetime. And his lifetime lasted for 239 years, according to chapter 11, verses 18 and 19. Now, of course, that 101 years that we came up with to start with is on the assumption that there are no gaps in the genealogy. And we've already talked about this, how sometimes there can be gaps when it might be a man to a grandson or a great-grandson even, and you get a couple of generations dropped out there. So there can be gaps like that. But assuming that there's no gaps, it would be about 101 years after the flood. But if there is no gaps, then that would place this event at Babel somewhere around 100 to 300 years after the flood. And we have no way of getting any more precise than that. And if there are gaps in that genealogy, it could be much longer than that. So we don't really have a good way of setting the time for certain, but we do know that some time has elapsed since the flood. And if you take the genealogies with birth rates and such, I've seen some calculations taking those with no gaps, that you can come up with probably several million people in the world by this time. And if indeed there are gaps and it's actually a longer time, then it could be considerably more. But easily there could be several million people in the world at this time. Now, at the time, we're told that the entire population of the earth was literally, it says here, one language and one speech, and this is literally in the Hebrew, one lip and one words. That's literally what it says. So what it means, obviously, is that they had one language, one vocabulary, one way of expressing themselves verbally. So different nations, then, had a shared common language, and that is one of the identifiers of nations. So obviously we're set up then for this account to follow. Now the project itself in Babel is given to us in verses 2 to 4. "And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they made brick," or they had brick for stone, "and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." So we see that a concentration of people grew in this land of Shinar, meaning there were different nations that were gathering here at Shinar. And what follows in this account, from what follows, it seems that this was a grouping and a centralizing of power. In other words, it's a bringing together of nations that would be inconsistent with the allotted territories of the nations and their spreading over the earth. So they're spreading out, as it talks about there, you know, they moved east and they found this plain. They're spreading out resulted in this grouping together. And then we're given an account of men speaking. Now, this is where you can particularly tell as you look at it. This speech is given in a very formal pattern. And it follows a very consistent pattern that is then mirror-reversed when God begins speaking after verse number 5. So this formal pattern has a way of emphasizing this speech. So obviously, speech is very important in this whole account of what happened in Babel. So when you compare the speech of men with God's speech in the creation to fall to flood accounts, you realize that Moses is putting their speech in a form that rivals God's. Now, we talked about how in the creation, even as you work through the creation week, you know, and God said, and it was so. And there's sort of a formality, almost a ceremony to the way that God moves through the creation, bringing into existence. And so the speech of men is given in a somewhat similar pattern here, as though they are rivaling God in their speak. In other words, they're presented to us to show us that they're speaking and they're acting like gods, little g, gods. They're acting like little c, creators. In other words, as though they can speak and it will be so. They say, oh, well, let us build a city. Let us build a tower. Let us use these materials and so on, as though they can simply speak and make it so. Now, as I understand the materials that are referred to, the brick and the slime, they're referring to a fire, kiln-fired bricks and a bitumen mastic for those. And that actually represents some technological advances that archaeologically would date, you know, back to about the time probably. So it could be that men saw this newer, more recent developed technology as a way of making their tower possible. And one application, obviously, that we might make from this account is that, first of all, advances in technology are not necessarily bad in and of themselves. I mean, some might be. But a technology, it's the technology's uses that has to be evaluated according to God's revealed will. And they're obviously using this technology to go against the Word of God. Now, the word for city has the idea of a guarded settlement, something that possibly could have been enclosed by a wall, something maybe that was, you know, elevated and maybe had some other natural features of the land that gave it protection on various sides, something that was defensible and guardable. So the purpose of the tower now, that they're going to build this tower, the purpose of the tower specifically is just simply not given to us. I've read a number of theories about what this tower could have been for and such, and certainly there are evidence of some tower building and those related to temples of various gods and things like that in ancient times, but we're really not told what the purpose exactly was. It's said that the top of the tower would reach unto heaven, which is an expression of great height, so that it would be considerably taller than other buildings. It's going to be the sort of the dominant feature of the skyline of this city. It's sort of like the way that we talk about skyscrapers, you know, these very, very large and obvious buildings, very tall. So it is a way of expressing great height. So it's going to be a monumental type accomplishment. And you know how that it can be between cities and building these high buildings and high towers, and they want to have the highest, you know, than somebody else. So all these measures that are taken were to make a name for themselves, a name for this coalition of nations. Rather than spreading over the earth, they would unite and build their own nation. In other words, as we look at Genesis 9 and 10 and what God has spoken to Noah, we certainly see that their words and their plans are being set against that. Rather than being spread, let's gather here. Let's build a city for our defense. Let's build a tower for our monument. Rather than being dispersed to allotted places of land, let's make a name for ourselves, they were saying. Now, there was obvious advantage in uniting. They would have this strength in numbers, a centralizing of power. There was obviously an advantage there. But the plan was obviously against God's expressed will concerning the nations. And so then we come down to the response, which gives us the conclusion of this particular account. That's in verses 5 to 9. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, "Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they began to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. So we're told, first of all, that God visits the sons of Adam. And so, of course, there is some irony, you might say, in this account. First of all, children of men listed there, that's literally sons of Adam. And Moses emphasizes that God had to come down to see the city and the tower. In other words, this Babel, this great city that was being built to make a great name for these nations that had come together, was below God. This pinnacle of human achievement was beneath God. He had to stoop down to see it. So God assessed their plans. God assessed their efforts that they were doing in Babel. And what they were attempting was they were attempting to establish a worldwide kingdom. And a kingdom where that all their commonalities, particularly in language, was helping them to accomplish. Now again, the way that the story is given to us, and particularly against the backdrop of the last couple of chapters, we see that they were in defiance against God, and that they would continue until the earth was like the pre-flood days again completely. So then what we get is God's speech, and God is deconstructing their plans and their speech literally. And again, as you put the two parts of the account together, you'll see that one is sort of the mirror image of the other as God undoes what they are attempting to do. So we're told that he divides the speech of the nations, and that divided the nations from each other. So through this, his will was accomplished, that these national identities were preserved and they were spread over the earth to particular inheritances. So this account then sets up a contrast between what God said and what man said. And again, there's an emphasis on speech as you read this account. The creation to fall to flood accounts have emphasized that God said, and it was so. And that's been the case in a number of ways. God said, and it was so, which applied to the creation, him bringing out of nothing. God said, and it was so, pertaining to the judgments that God made, even the judgment of the flood. God said, and it was so, which is also true of the obedience of Noah, as we don't get speech from Noah. We get this speech from God, and Noah kept all that God commanded. God spoke, and it was so. So in different ways, in all these accounts leading up to this point, God spoke, and it was so. Now here, we're presented, first of all, at the beginning of chapter 11, with man speaking as though they were gods and could make their own inheritance, but it isn't so, because God overrules. Then we come to verses 10 to 32, which is the rest of this chapter, sort of a lengthy section, which gives us this genealogy that gets us from Shem to Abraham. The first part of it, verse 10 to 26, give us the genealogy of Shem in particular. These are the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he begat Arphaxad 500 years and begat sons and daughters. And Arphaxad lived 530 years and begat Salah. And Arphaxad lived after he begat Salah 403 years and begat sons and daughters. And Salah lived 30 years and begat Eber. And Salah lived after he begat Eber 403 years and begat sons and daughters. And Eber lived 430 years and begat Peleg. And Eber lived after he begat Peleg 430 years and begat sons and daughters. And Peleg lived 30 years and begat Reu. And Peleg lived after he begat Reu 209 years and begat sons and daughters. And Reu lived 230 years and begat Serug. And Reu lived after he begat Serug 207 years and begat sons and daughters. And Serug lived 30 years and begat Nahor. And Serug lived after he begat Nahor 200 years and begat sons and daughters. And Nahor lived 29 years and begat Terah. And Nahor lived after he begat Terah 119 years and begat sons and daughters. And Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So we are confronted here with another genealogy. We've just had the genealogies of the previous chapters and the Table of Nations in chapter 10, and now we encounter another genealogy. And coming after the Table of Nations the way that it does, this isn't simply a repeat. It's not just a repetitive account. It's actually unique. In other words, it's the Table of Nations is unique. It's not exactly a genealogy, and this is more of a genealogy. This list is more in line with that family genealogy. And what we are tracing here is the seed line, that seed promise from Genesis 3:15, the seed of the woman that would crush the head of the serpent. And we are whittling that down to Abraham. And then we know that through Abraham in particular is the seed going to come. As we continue to work through Genesis and so on, we'll see that seed line being narrowed down and being maintained. So on the one hand, this accounting gives us a preservation of that seed line, that promise that God has given of that one to be born. And the obvious purpose of this list is to get from Shem, which is Noah's son, to Abraham. Once again, we have to remember that this is the history of Israel. One way of putting it would be that the Pentateuch is written to Israel, sort of like the New Testament epistles are written to churches. So the 1 Corinthians was written to the church at Corinth. Now, there's things in it that are certainly applicable to other churches and other Christians or what have you, other than just the church at Corinth, but it's written to the church at Corinth. Well, the Pentateuch, the books of Moses, are written to Israel. This is their history. This is what they're continually commanded to remember, to consider, to teach to their children, and so on. So this is the history of Israel. It is the history of that seed promise that's going to come through Israel. And so obviously the purpose of this genealogy is to give us that descent from Shem to Abraham. And then we get the end of the chapter in verses 27 to 32. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, and the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren, she had no child. And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, and his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So now we get this focus. We slow down at Terah because he was the father of Abraham. And from Terah to Abraham, we're getting more information. This isn't, strictly speaking, just a genealogy here at the end. This account introduces key people to us. It introduces key information for us as we're going to go into the following chapters as Genesis continues to unfold. So we learn things like the land of Abraham's birth was Ur of the Chaldees. And Ur of the Chaldees, where Joshua said that Abraham's family was idolaters. Joshua chapter 24 and verse number 2. And Joshua said unto all the people, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, Your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood in old time, even Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. Now that word for flood there doesn't mean, it's not talking about the global flood. The word there can mean a flood, it can mean a river, it can mean a stream, it can even mean a sea. And he's talking about river. That is, as I understand it, the meaning of the name Abar, I think, is from across the river. Something like that. But anyway, that's what Joshua is talking about. They were outside of the land of Canaan. They're on the other side of the river, outside of the land of Canaan. And they were idolaters. We also learn here that Abraham married. He married Sarah, as her name is changed later, and just as Abram's name is changed to Abraham later. But she was unable to have children. So we're told that in this account, obviously setting us up for what is to follow. We also learn of Lot, Abraham's brother's son, or Abraham's nephew, which is also going. He will also feature in the ongoing storyline of Genesis. And then we also learn that they were on the way to Canaan, and Terah, Abraham's father, died in Haran. So as we think of chapter number 11 and sort of the part that it plays in this story of Genesis, this chapter certainly shows us the corruption of nations. In other words, after the flood, God has established this order. And God has determined for there to be these nations that are spread abroad on the earth with all these identifiers that we are given. But yet, in chapter 11, we see that mankind is corrupting the nations and God's purpose there. And they're trying to make all one. Instead of distinct nations with appointed boundaries, they're trying to have one world kingdom. Now, this situation happened soon after the flood. And again, could have probably been just a few hundred years amount of time. But it also shows us once again the consistency of sin as mankind was trending back to the pre-flood sins, those sins of violence, of conquest and rebellion against God's word. They were supposed to spread over the earth and fill the earth as nations, and instead they were gathering together in one, trying to build their own kingdom. And the account also sets us up, obviously, for the emergence of Abraham and for the making of Israel and Israel's purpose as God's witnesses to the nations. So as we see this corruption of the nations, and Paul, I believe, refers to this in Acts chapter number 17 as a time of ignorance. The nations have corrupted their way. They have forgotten God. They've sought out other gods. Paul, I believe, is also referring to this time in Romans chapter number 1 when he says, when they knew God, they did not acknowledge him. They did not worship him as creator, but rather they worshiped the creation and so on. So the account sets us up now because out of this corruption of nations, God's going to make a new nation. And this new nation is going to be a specially chosen, a specially formed nation in order to function as his witnesses to the other nations of the earth. So all this is being set up for us. So Moses wrote this account, particularly the beginning of this account, the event in Babel. He wrote this in such a way to make the speech be featured, the speech of the men of Babel on one side and the speech of God on the other. So the men of Babel, they reject the speech of God, and they put their own speech against it. I mean, it's written in such a way as almost as if they're saying, I know that God said do this, but instead we're going to do this. This is a better plan. This is better for us, and we're going to do things this way. It's really put that starkly in contrast. But God's speech in the account is the speech that prevails. God is the one who speaks, and it is so. And that's whether men want it to be so or not, or whether men oppose it to be so or not. God speaks, and it is so, yet again, being shown to us in this book. So he undoes the speech of men. So one of the, obviously, a major lesson that we would take away in terms of practical application is that it is disobedience. It is rebellion to go against God's word. Now, it is very human of us to think that we have a better plan than God, to think that we have a better way of running things and of doing things than what God has said in His Word. But to deliberately go against the Word of God, it is the sin of Babel. And obviously, a sin which must be repented of and forsaken. And faith, just as it was in Noah's case, and just as it's going to be shown to us in Abraham's case, is believing God and keeping His Word.